It is a very violent time when a technology is emerging, because you're making more trade-offs than you will have to later when you're adopting it early.
Hello, I am Cody Ellingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. My guest today is Kian Kusha, the founder of Stacker News. Stacker News is an online forum where you can share and discuss articles and content without the attention manipulation of social media. Instead of likes or invisible algorithms, Stacker News uses Bitcoin as an incentive mechanism and for ranking content, rewarding users for thoughtful contributions and enabling you to support your favorite content with micropayments via the Bitcoin Lightning Network. Kian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Cody.
I've been a big fan of Stacker News for a couple of years now. It's pretty much the first thing I'll look at in the morning. It's where I like to get a lot of my news. And I find it does a great job of surfacing things that are interesting to me. In short, it feels like an oasis of calm in this world of noise. But it's been pretty much 4 years, I think, since you launched Stacker News. What have you learned since then about how to build a good community?
Oh, gosh. I think the biggest thing I've learned is that it's not much different than what you want in a community in person. It's kind of what you'd expect. You want thoughtful people helping each other out, doing things for each other to the extent that they can, and that's most of what it is. It really doesn't get much more complicated than that in terms of what makes a good community. It's online, it's a bit different, but I think most of what we seek online is like a hyper version of what we get in person. And so, or a greater quantity of what we might get in person, more efficient delivery of community of what we might get in person. So a lot of it's the same. It's where people join some group or some group of people where the sum of them all together is somehow greater than their parts, where their life is better, more full, more productive. That's what, though, at least that's how I view it at this stage.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You know, there's this kind of interesting difference between the way the internet is this globalizing force where you can connect with anyone versus what I think is the innate desire for local communities and people around you. And it does feel like Stacker News has been able to make that happen. It feels like a very comfortable place, and I hate to say it, but you know, a safe place in the sense that you can have these nuanced conversations, and in a sense it does feel like it also comes back to the incentives. And so I mean, that word sounds a little bit utilitarian, you know, oh, it's all about the incentives, but it does seem to make a difference. And so you've written a little bit about natural communities and how this project was all inspired from, was it the Austin Bitcoin Devs meetup originally that you went to?
Yeah, I went to the Austin Bit Devs.
And you felt something there that was sort of like like in real life, there was this community, there were people, you know, kind of connecting, and you were trying to look for a way to bring that online, right?
Yeah. I'd been a fan of online communities like Hacker News for years, and I'd learned a lot in those communities that I wouldn't have learned otherwise. I'd learned things that without the internet, without a site like Hacker News, I might have had to have 10,000 friends to tell me about all the things that were happening in technology. And instead I could find that on Hacker News. And then I moved to Austin trying to get closer to Bitcoiners, and I went to the meetups here, and they were great. They were basically what I was looking for on Hacker News for technology, but for Bitcoin. And I couldn't find anywhere online that had the Hacker News feel. And so I had to move to Austin to get it. And I was so frustrated that I couldn't find anything on the internet that resembled Hacker News, but for Bitcoin stuff. And that was kind of the beginning. And then shortly after, I discovered the Lightning Network. And there was a project called Sphinx Chat, which still exists today. Really clever. Uses the Lightning Network to protect chats, like big group chats, protect spam. And Ryan Gentry talked about it at one of these bit devs. And I was like, oh, I can create a hacker news like site for Bitcoin stuff using the Lightning Network to make it sane and comfy and prevent a lot of bad stuff from happening that usually requires a lot of human subjectivity that ends up, I think, on some level eroding what makes a community good is the kind of inclusivity and the and especially online communities, pseudonymity. So that's kind of the where BitDevs plays.
And yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned Hacker News, and I mean, I have used that before. Reddit is also a more distant kind of resembling this forum, this kind of messaging board system. There is resemblances there technically, but I really do feel like there's something special about Stack and News, and that Hacker News, it's a clique, you know, like there's certain things you can't talk about, and there's a certain expectation about the way you should approach certain topics, and there is a group think, and I don't get that same vibe with Stack News, and maybe this is because I'm a Bitcoiner myself, but It feels a little bit more like you can have like an actual nuanced discussion. And have you reflected on that difference, especially with Hacker News and sort of the culture?
Yeah, it's hard to tell what of Stacker News is Stacker News because of the incentives. What is Stacker News because it's small? I had a conversation with my friend this morning about that, and we were like, okay, Stacker News gets 10 times bigger. Do the market dynamics really preserve this like nuanced discussion and this thoughtful feedback I get? Will I be as vulnerable? My contention is yes. I think it's mostly the market incentives that make it work that way, and not the size. But yeah. And then to the point about it being like Hacker News being cliquish, I get a lot of complaints from people who are like in the periphery of Bitcoin, people who are working on these like other layer twos that kind of get marginalized among Bitcoiners. And the feedback I get is that Stacker News is an echo chamber. So I think it just, and I imagine if you're within the clique on Hacker News, you don't
feel it.
Yeah, you don't sense it. And so perhaps we do have a cliquish nature. And I don't think that's even necessarily bad. I think you don't want it, maybe in a case where the group is doing something sort of pathological and to their detriment, but in the case where, you know, it's keeping out scams or things that are bad, it's probably good. So it could be, but we still get a lot of content that's posted about those other things. They just don't get much attention, and they might do well if those people who posted about those things brought other people who like them and talked about them. But the nature of those scams is they don't really have organic participants, really. They have promoters, and promoters don't really want to have thoughtful conversations about those things. They mostly want to talk about how they're going to trade it in the right way or whatever. And I just don't think that perhaps the format almost filters that out to some extent.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. So there's two points there. You also write that your assumption is that with Stack and News, Bitcoin fixes the incentives by having users stake something other than just pseudo reputation. And through Bitcoin, they earn rewards that are worth something in the external world. And there's something quite powerful about that, because there's not really any rate limit or anything slowing you down from spinning up a new Twitter account or whatever. And, you know, you get these bot farms and all sorts of stuff. And that's got its own externalities the attitude of somewhere like X is that, you know, you just broadcast this stuff out. And it does feel like, you know, there is a reward in Stacking News for this kind of more nuanced content and a focus. But what I wanted to just pick up on, something you mentioned around these like people on the fringes, marginal layer two conversations, you know, people who maybe don't fit within a strict so-called Bitcoin maximalist lens. What's your experience been with those kinds of people that maybe they've been, haven't, that they say it's an echo chamber, but they still get value from it? Or like, what, how have they felt about Stacking Use as a community?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had a super in-depth conversation with them, but they tend to crop up every now and again when a conversation about growth or something like that comes up with Stacker News, and they're like, Stacker News will never get very big. It's an echo chamber for Bitcoin maximalists. You can't talk about really anything else but Bitcoin. And I'm the type of person where I'm sympathetic to nearly, I can't see everything. I can't tell everything that's going on. If they're going to use their body's senses and their mind's processing power to communicate information about a product that I'm working on, I'm going to listen. And so I think that that could be true. That could be a problem from the perspective of a large number of people, is that things that they want to talk about aren't present there. They're not treated properly. And I'm not sure how to change that. We don't do that. That isn't an intention of us to marginalize those communities. But there might be, in the incentives of Stacker News and the way it works, there might be an indirect consequence. And yeah.
That's interesting, because I have a few friends who, you know, love coming onto Stacker News, and they're not what I would think of as, you know, hardcore maximalists, in the sense that they're into Bitcoin, but they're not that into it. And I think, you know, I look at some of the, like, the writing and the photography and the philosophy and stuff there, and it's like, man, it's kind of an eclectic, very interesting mix of things that, in a way, man, reminds me a lot of the old internet. And there's this website I used to go to, you might know it, and it's called everythink2.com. Have you ever come across that?
I might have.
It's kind of like, you know, there's kind of long format, very simple, you know, pages, but long format articles that people wrote. And it was really popular, like, early 2000s. And it's like, you'd find these essays on, like, the history of anything. And it's kind of like Wikipedia, but a lot more creative. And it was also mixed in there with, like, people's blogs and their stories. And it's just this discoverability that, to this day, I still look back at that and think, man, some of these, like, short stories that were written by some NIM, or these, like, reflections on, you know, the history of even some of the stuff we're interested in, like encryption and technology. You know, they just had this kind of human touch, even though they were NIMs. Mm-hmm. And it just stands as, like, a moment in the internet that, in a way, now it's very old school, but it was very powerful. And I think this also reflects something, you know, maybe before our time, but the Usenet era. And I don't know if you were around for that, but
no.
It seemed like, you know, that this was a thing, a moment that our, you know, our ancestors kind of went through, where there was this, you know, this new thing, the internet, and people could get involved and they could communicate, and there was an etiquette for the way you talk. But then, as you know, famously, the eternal September, you know, these AOL opened it all up, and this flood of new users came in, and you know, that etiquette kind of got diluted. But it just feels like there is a sweet spot with Stacking News where you can have these conversations. And I wonder if you've thought about the relationship with something like the old Bitcoin Talk forums as well, and sort of where those have gone since, say, 2013 compared to today.
Yeah, well, I wasn't really even around Bitcoin back then, so I didn't get to participate in the heyday of the Bitcoin Talk, unfortunately. So I don't really know. I do know I would find myself on the forum occasionally much later, seeing things that were really interesting and names that I would remember, OGs that had kind of stuck around, and ones, and for the most part ones that had kind of disappeared, and then a lot of them having, you know, complex journeys after, you know, maybe thinking that blockchain could provide other types of services on the internet, and maybe not. But I recall, you know, having this desire to find a Hacker News. I was searching on the internet for something like Hacker News for Bitcoin stuff, and I found myself on Bitcoin Talk trying to get into it, but I would run into so much spam and so many scams that I couldn't tolerate it. I have like a low threshold for that kind of stuff. I don't I don't like to be assaulted by too much noise. I get very frustrated, and you know, a lot platforms like Hacker News, they have most of the product is probably on the like filtering side of preventing spam, preventing bad people from banning people, all those kinds of things. That's what they do to preserve it. And I think Bitcoin Talk attempting to toe a line, I think maybe got kind of overwhelmed with that kind of stuff. And then you also have the issue of like, how do I find things surface kind of weird in an old forum system like that, where I think it's primarily based on activity. So it has like a huge recency bias in terms of comment and participation rather than content quality. And you'll get, you know, things that have high comments are often maybe low quality. They're just, you know, controversial. And so there's a lot of things that can go wrong when you bring people together on the internet, operating under pseudonyms. And that was my perception of Bitcoin Talk, was sort of it survived while it was small. I'm not sure. And it's still used by a lot of people today, but it's not a place I can go and feel like it's worth it.
Yeah. Well, even, I mean, there's these characters we have on Stacking News, right? And I think there's something quite endearing about that. And again, it does, maybe this is me being a millennial, getting nostalgic about the old internet of my childhood, but it just feels like, you know, it takes me back to a simpler time. And even the design of it, you know, it's very clean and easy to use on your phone, on any device. You know, you're not being assaulted by these images and these kind of dopamine hits. And honestly, Kian, you strike me as a very creative and thoughtful person. And I wonder how that has fed into what you've done here. You know, this kind of clean, minimalist design, this kind of sense of a community, the sense of creating something deeper. Like, have you reflected on that? Even though you're a tech person, like, do you consider yourself a creative person as well? Or
yeah, I don't know. I don't think of myself in terms of positive labels, which I don't know what to make of that. But I've been told I'm creative before. I spent my early 20s doing a lot of art. So I did. I used to be an oil painter for a period of time, did a lot of graffiti. You know, had some reckless times too during that period. And then I finally found tech after a long time. But yeah, I mean, I think if we did like a personality test, I'm probably high openness relative to most people. So, and I think that, and then I'm also, I think based on the tests I've taken, high in conscientiousness. And I think those are the things for creativity. That's kind of what I got.
So, yeah. Sorry. I don't mean to put labels out there. I have the same issue. I don't like, you know, people are like, what do you do, Cody? And I'm like, man, I can't even tell you, but, What I'm getting at though is, if I reflect on again kind of the archetype, the founding archetype that comes into something, when I reflect on, you know, Zuckerberg or, you know, one of these kinds of characters, and you think, man, you know, these are kind of engineers, they're kind of quantifying things, the numbers are algorithmic. But even though there's this simplicity and this cleanness to Stacking News, it's like that kind of founding ethos feels like it comes through. And that's why I think I respond to it, and the couple of friends I know who use it in real life are a little bit more creative. Like, one's a musician, they're kind of thinkers, philosophers, and there's this kind of vibe going. And I don't know, man, maybe we're all just kind of syncing up on this like nebula of the internet, but I feel it, you know?
Yeah, I think that definitely makes sense. I'm trying to express myself through Stacker News. That's kind of the way I view it, is I'm trying to pour my life's energy, I'm trying to like transmute it, my time and my life's energy and my experiences into a product such that it brings value to other people and it somehow can be transferred and have an impact on other people. And I think that probably does register. I think that's what anyone who needs expression or just simply wants it, that's what they end up striving for in the end.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the other one that sort of, you know, I live here in Japan and I'm part of this writers group, and it's kind of really incredible. You know, we've all started using Substack and like sharing each other's work, and we meet up in real life, and it's kind of, you know, it's very quaint and kind of, you know, fun, but it's incredible to see like the way those real life communities can then be connected virtually, and it just feels like a very big change to what I guess I grew up with, which was the Facebook, Instagram era and this kind of mass panopticon thing. And maybe this is something that younger people are already starting to wake up to. I think, you know, Gen Z feels like they're much more interested in like private groups and like small chats and kind of getting off of being this like public persona, at least from a lot of the stuff I've seen. I mean, not obviously not everyone, but a lot of people do seem to be migrating towards that kind of more local thing, you know, things like Signal groups for your friends. It feels like there is this kind of move, this pendulum swing back to smaller, more intimate groups, perhaps. And I don't know if you have any thoughts maybe on that.
No, I think I've observed that too. I think that's just the way technology goes, as we go really hard in one direction and then we end up realizing our mistake and we kind of swing back. So I do think I see that happening. I think most people use a lot of these platforms now in some sense to promote themselves or simply collect followers as a kind of a number go up metric for themselves, or, you know, in the hopes that later they'll be able to somehow monetize their followership. It's less about kind of companionship than it used to be. And I don't know who's to blame for that exactly. You know, it might be sort of like a mass hysteric kind of phenomena where we're all just kind of being kind of, you know, making this mistake together. Or it might be the algorithm, or it might be the advertisers. But it is definitely a mistake. I think it is wrong. I don't think it's what we want to do. And I do see that as reassuring. I think it's exactly what people want, is especially with people you know or people you otherwise trust for some reason, have small conversations. You know, I'm at, you look at like some of these big celebrities, it's not like I don't think who they are is their is like represented in their Twitter feed. Maybe aside from Elon Musk, I think that's true. Elon Musk might be an exception to that, but I think about someone like Jack Dorsey. Where is he spending his time on the internet? It's probably in these private chats. I mean, you can't show up somewhere as Jack Dorsey and not just get mobbed by, you know, people with mixed intentions. So,
yeah. Well, a key word that comes out for me is web of trust. And this is something, you know, back in New Zealand, we sort of developed this. We had a few Telegram groups and Signal groups with some of my Bitcoin friends. And for various reasons, you know, it seemed appropriate at the time to really be focused on web of trust. And so if you trust someone, they can then invite someone else to join this group. And it basically self-regulated quite well. And we still have some of these groups going. And I compare that with like open, you know, back in the heyday, 2021, sort of, you know, bull run, whatever, you know, had these like open groups where there was like scammers and people getting like rugged and like getting all sorts of issues. And that seemed to have made a huge difference, where we've got this group that's based on, you know, if you trust someone, then by virtue, I'm going to trust that person too. And it seemed to work, you know. And I imagine that at all layers of human relations, that web of trust is going to play a role, right?
Yeah, I think it's an abstraction on something that occurs naturally in humans. I think, you know, the digital webs of trust that we form, I think it's just, you know, the internet's manifestation of that. You know, and I think we use something we call web of trust to rank content and to determine whether someone's zaps are more authentic and, you know, than someone else's. And we do that based on their zaps relationships to other people. If you and I zap the same things, you and I trust each other's zaps. And so if you zap something, I want to be more likely to see it. If I zap something, you want to be more likely to see it. And And then we extend that out further. It has like this kind of, you know, the transitive nature, this friends of friends thing. And it has this kind of decay as it kind of goes out. Like I may trust your friends of friend half of what I trust you. And then I might trust their friends half as much as I trust them and so on. And I think that is, you know, that is just how we naturally want to do things. Cause it is, you know, agents, humans are self-interested agents to a large degree, I think for good and, you know, to some extent for bad. And so trust plays a critical role in assessing whether you want to partner or engage with another human being. So I think it makes a lot of sense to have webs of trust everywhere.
Yeah. Well, something I wanted to ask you about, which I've been thinking about, Kian, is this idea of walled gardens. And I think this gets a hot take from one end of the spectrum, which is that, you know, walled gardens are bad. We've got to break these walls down and go open. Yet, I also think that there is a nuance, because we know, you know, if you just have an open Telegram group where anyone can come in, or you, you know, some kind of open group, doesn't matter what the tech is, you are going to have issues. And, you know, some people coming in who are bad actors, and this is a classic issue. The bad apple spoils the lot. And I think I want to hear your thoughts, because I get the impression that you have thought about this deeply, and the nuance between walled gardens and open and closed systems.
Yeah. Yeah, I think everyone tends to define a walled garden to suit themselves, and no one, and we use a walled garden to mean something bad, and so no one uses a walled garden to describe their own work or their own whatever, even though in reality, and you know, if you come across a walled garden, it's quite nice if you can somehow get inside of it. And so my intention with Stacker News was to not, whatever someone might think it is, was not to create a walled garden. It was to create a garden. So I just want to create a garden, and to the extent that there are walls, I wanted them to be defined by things that everyone has access to, so long as they are motivated enough, which is money. And so I didn't want it to be gated by identity. I didn't want it to be gated by who, you know. Web of Trust by itself tends to be very exclusive. So I might have a very hard time contacting Cody if I have no relationship to him, with, you know, which I might not, if in a world of 8 billion people. And so, but if Cody's willing to accept an invitation to talk from anyone, and I have, but for the small price of 10 sats, I can get access to Cody. And so that's the wall. That's the only wall that I wanted on a garden. When people in Bitcoin describe Stacker News as a walled garden, and they mean it as like in a bad way, they mean that the content itself and perhaps even their identity on Stacker News cannot leave very effectively. And I'm sympathetic to that. I think that actually is, you know, it's not a quality that I want Stacker News to have, but I do want it to have, I do want it to be a garden. I don't want it to be a trash heap, a wall-less trash heap. That is not what I want it to be. I want it to be a wall-less garden. But there is, I think, to keep it a garden, we need a wall that is or a gate that is very easy to enter with payment. But we perhaps do not need a wall such that people can't view the garden or participate in gardening easily, those kinds of things, and maybe even leave to go to another garden, I think is what how a lot of people frame this now. Is like, if I'm growing my watermelons in Stacker News's garden, I cannot move to Reddit's garden with those watermelons trivially, so therefore it's a walled garden, that's bad. And I would agree with them, it'd be nice for them to be able to leave with the watermelons and go somewhere else. Yeah.
I wonder if there's nuance to that, though, because I'm aware that there has been a few people who have made that critique, the walled garden critique of Stacker News, and I disagree with that, and I think those are actually bad faith attacks on what you have done, which is build this incredible community. But in this idea of you pay to get in. You know, there's many things. You know, I live near Tokyo. It's like 20 million people. You know, there's many things that are like nice to pay for, and you get a better service, right? But I actually wonder, coming back to kind of the engineering mind versus the creative mind, that there's almost this kind of idea that, you know, somehow, you know, if I could only port my content over, if I could only bring it with me. And I sometimes wonder exactly what is meant by that, because identity is one thing, but there's a spirit and there's a time. And, you know, you could easily just go into Bitcoin Talk and bring all of that content to a new forum, but maybe no one's going to use it and it becomes more like an archive. And I mean, stacking users is, you know, it's all public stuff. So, you know, you can scrape it if you really wanted to, but it feels like the essence of it, the kind of the soul of it, is this web of trust and these people who are using it and they're coming there every day. And I don't know if you can just like migrate that very easily. And I think there's like an indescribable quality that maybe an engineering mind wouldn't pick up on, that, well, if we just could port it through some API to this thing, you know, that it would, you know, it would be okay. But there's an essence, I feel. Well, I mean, what do you think about that?
I think that's insightful. I think that's there's like a context in which we engage with other people, and so this conversation, I'm not gonna have this conversation with my mom. This podcast is a walled garden because I can't port this conversation and have it exactly with my mom. It won't make sense. It's your fault, Cody. I think the context really matters. There are certain kinds of content, like, you know, a post about something really interesting that is portable, and perhaps that deserves to be portable. But it's not like the human language itself is a protocol, and so I can copy and paste human language, and that is so it is portable. So there is a lot of nuance here. But I'm sympathetic to the idea that it shouldn't be copy-paste, it should be more automatic, it should be programmable, it should be so much better, it should be whatever it can be. It should give people as much freedom as possible and as easy as possible. I'm sympathetic to all that. But I am also defensive of the context, the garden, the soil, the quality of experience in the garden, all of those kinds of things. I don't want those to be degraded in service of whatever someone else thinks is ideal. I think in most cases where they have that criticism, they haven't spent a lot of time on Stacker News, or they just don't really care and haven't given it much thought.
If I can make a proposition here, I actually wonder, there's one person in particular, I wonder if that person is actually the right vibe for Stacker News, because there's a certain humility required, there's a certain openness required to be using Hacker News, I think, or not required, but it certainly suits a collegiate, you know, open discourse. And, you know, if that's not what someone's into, then, you know, they can go and use X and shout in X, or they can go and use some other platform and use that. But I feel like, in a way, it's almost like, I mean, the old school subculture idea. You know, we've got our hood, man. We've got our place where we hang out, and I love it. It's because it, I mean, certainly in the earlier 2000s, you know, certainly in the 20th century, you know, subcultures were a thing. And then we saw Facebook and the Facebook phenomena, and we just saw the concrete utilitarian infrastructure of this place. And you have one color for everyone. You have one thing for everyone. And that was like the killer. That was like the highway through the eclectic neighborhood in Louisiana or something that just like demolished all of this fabric. And now maybe it's healing. Maybe we're starting to get places like Stacker News. I mean, there's a few other places, you know, I have my own signal groups with my friends, my art friends, I got my Bitcoin friends on other groups, and we got these little like patchworks. And it's kind of like, I wonder, I'm really interested, Kian, in like urban planning and like cities and like what makes a good city, and like what is it about Austin that makes it so much more like livable and hip than like, I don't know, Dallas, or what makes you know, a small East Coast city like really fun and easy to live in versus like Los Angeles. And there's something there, but it's like density, like community. There's all these pieces, right? And maybe that's an interesting way to frame this, right? Is like cities versus, you know, digital communities.
Yeah. No, I think that's really interesting. I've tried to draw that comparison myself. Unfortunately, I haven't gone very deep in the urban planning sense, but I do try to pull ideas from urban planning into Stacker News, or I have plans to pull certain ideas from urban planning into Stacker News. Like one of the more popular books on urban planning, I forget the name of it, but it's a woman who lived in New York City, and she's
Jane
describing
Jacobs.
Yeah, that's probably it. But I was stuck on the idea of sidewalks being the critical element that makes a city really a city, like makes it a very nice city to be in that is like self-policing, and because that makes a lot of sense for Stacker News, given that we want it to be self-policing, we don't want to have police. We want citizen police, like they had in New York City at one time, as the author argues. And so, how do I bring wider sidewalks? How do I bring more sidewalks to Stacker News? How do I make more functional sidewalks? I think about that kind of stuff. I do think about to the extent that I think about city planning, you know, our territory. Territories. I want to give the territory founders as many dials as possible. Territories are like Stacker News's version of subreddits, and I want to give the territory founders as many dials as possible, such that they get to decide whether their city is Boston or their territory is Boston or LA or whatever. And you know, perhaps to their own peril, decide incorrectly how to get there. But I do think it's a great analogy. I think it lines up perfectly. Translating them is like hard, though. I don't know how to do it exactly.
Yeah, no. So I'm pretty sure it's Jane Jacobs, the Death and Life of Great American Cities that you're referring to. And she was writing in the 1950s, 1960s, and at that time New York was like putting these highways through Manhattan and like just destroying these communities. And in a sense, I mean, the New York of today is a very different place to what it once was. And there's another concept that's quite interesting that she talks about a lot, which is like the watching eyes. And so, you know, you'd have these like small, the communities in like Manhattan, and you'd have like the grandma sitting on the stoop, like watching. You would have the shop owner, like all of these different people just kind of watching. And the kids would stay in line because there was like an older figure there was this kind of watchful eye. And that's not something you get in like a mass suburbia. That's not something you get in concrete highways or freeway territory. And that kind of community, as you say, it's like self-policing. There's sort of just like enough of a range of people that it just sort of holds together in the strata, which is very interesting.
My takeaway is mostly the sidewalk thing, and that's what brought the grandma to the stoop, is because there's enough going on that she can entertain herself by sitting on the stoop, because there's a wide sidewalk where lots of people are hanging out, and all of those people are also contributing to the watching eyes, and the kids are able have enough space to play on the sidewalk. The adults have enough space to have dinner if they want to have dinner. I had a friend who was in France recently, and he said he was walking around and people were just having dinner on the sidewalks. They pulled the table out and they were just hanging out having dinner. And these are, this friend travels to France for these types of experiences, because they don't get these experiences in the United States. And, is that the sidewalk? Is it, kind of this kind of generational traditional thing where someone's in the same house for a long time? And I don't know exactly what it is, but I think she has a point with the sidewalks. I do think that is an aspect of it is creating this communal public space where everyone can meet and everyone can see, and everyone has some interest in keeping it good. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating way to look at it. And I mean, the other thing that does happen on sidewalks is you bump into someone and you have a conversation, and you don't. And again, I just wonder whether, there's something here that, one day the anthropologists will look back and they'll say, the Facebook, it was the freeway moment. It was the Detroit moment where we said, we can just build bigger. We can make it this amazing, huge thing. But actually what we needed was something a bit more smaller, intimate, local. And I mean, I do feel that with Stack and News. And I feel like as we enter into this kind of brave new world that's coming, which feels kind of weird, you know, it's like I'm going through this transition myself, man. It's like, you know, the world I knew 10, 15 years ago, you know, it's sort of slowly just slipping away and we're moving into a new place. And I think kind of adapting to that and kind of almost healing from that is part of what we're coming into. And I don't know, man, it's a big idea. And then like, how do you translate that into a piece of, you know, software, into a website, right?
Yeah, I don't know. That's what I get to spend the rest of my life doing. And so I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do think we do have some healing to do. I do think getting smaller, getting more local is generally more healthy. But I also wonder about how you get there's value to what the Facebooks of the world provide. There's value to what the Amazons and the Wall, even though we hate them on so many levels, there is something that they're providing for us, and that's why they end up taking over. And it's not just that they are manipulating us exclusively. They are also providing value, and there's something like we want scale. We want lots of people together as much as possible. Mm. It's kind of something we desire. And how do you just do that in a healthy way? So that's like another thing I think about. It's like maybe we don't need to go smaller. I think we mostly just want to go healthier. And I don't know. I don't know if you can get both. You don't know if you can get scale and health and preserve health, but. That's like another side to it.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, man. Just like a little anecdote for you. So I'm from New Zealand originally, and we don't have Amazon in New Zealand, and it's very much like kind of a pain to get stuff. Like, you know, it's certainly now that I live in Japan, it's like next day, same day delivery. I can get anything. I don't have to go to the shop, and that's like I've had to learn that, and like my default kind of. Arcadian background in the hills and the farmland of New Zealand is, you know, we didn't have that. And I realized for a long time I was kind of a contrarian. I was like, you know, like fuck Amazon, you know, like, pardon my French, but like I kind of felt this kind of negativity towards it, certainly with my own business. I was like, man, I don't want to use Amazon. I want to own my own, you know, customer list. I don't want to be dealing with their systems. But now I'm like, yeah, actually I kind of appreciate the incentives are there for like scale and for like getting it out to people. And I haven't really fully thought this through, but there's some sort of change that I've witnessed in myself. Like I kind of understand there's value in these large systems, these, you know, many to many networks that I kind of was just by default against for some reason before. And I tried to roll my own. I had my own like website and stuff, but you know, you just get so much more traffic when you run it through Amazon, and there's like a discoverability, there's a graph, a social graph, all of this stuff. And yeah, as you say, you know, is there a healthy way of doing that? And that's maybe the key part, is like, yeah, how to do that in a good's a problematic word, but you know, in a healthy way perhaps.
Yeah, and I think that I'm an optimist, and I think that's the arrow of time, the like technology is that we do get things that we want that are healthier generally. And so I think, you know, the Amazons of tomorrow, maybe, you know, before the internet, we didn't have Amazons and it was all about scale. I think the Amazons of tomorrow are probably the Amazons that achieve the scale, but in a way that people have like less regret and less negative feelings about it. I think, you know, regret minimization is like a term that gets thrown around in social media circles, because a lot of these products are, One technology group at a company is trying to addict people to their feed, and then another technology group is trying to preserve the mental health of people, and it's they end up in this weird situation. But I think you just I think you want to you probably want to start from a foundation where the health is kind of a key aspect that you are addressing.
Yeah. Speaking of health, I would be curious what your relationship's like with your smartphone. Do you find yourself as the kind of person who puts it away and goes for a long walk without it? Or are you using it just normally, or, you know, more than average? Like, how would you rate that?
Oh, I would say I'm below average. I only really use Stacker News on my phone. And that is, I do spend quite a bit of time on Stacker News because it's like my work. but yes. And I'm doing a lot of customer support. I have a lot of friends on Stacker News I'm talking to. So I do spend a lot of time on I would guess probably roughly an hour or so on my phone on Stacker News, mostly just when I'm away from my laptop and I can't interact that way. But when I typically walk or bike to and from home every day, and that is without, I'm not really doing much. I'm just kind of either ruminating is probably my natural state, but you know, thinking, reminiscing, I don't know, whatever. Just kind of thinking about something I read, or like, okay, I'm working on, how can I get good at coding in my brain as I'm walking? Can I this problem, I can't solve it. Maybe I can just, if I could just think about it the right way and I can go over every possible combination of the way it can be done, maybe I'll. And so I think there's a lot to that. I'm spending, over the last couple of weeks, I've been spending a lot more time doing that kind of thing where I'm kind of away, I'm kind of separated from the devices, and just thinking. And it's really nice. I think it's a very, like a natural, healthy state. But I don't use other social media, really. I use Noster, I'll use Domus on my phone. And I'll use Twitter a little bit to, it's so hard. It's like fighting like a current when I go to the main feed, cause they just suck you in so hard with the algorithm. But, I'll try to get to a list where I have a few lists of like, okay, here's some Bitcoin developers who I know are like not noisy. Here's a group of like AI people that are great. Here's a group of people I see as like mentors that I'm going to passively intake their wisdom. And that's how I consume something like Twitter if I'm going to do it. But I don't do Instagram or anything really else.
Would you be willing to share with me who's inspired you or who has provided some of that thought leadership that you follow?
Yeah. I mean, it's probably unsurprising, but Paul Graham is a big influence. He's a founder of Hacker News, founder of Y Combinator. I think he's responsible probably for most of startup culture, most of the products we use on the internet. I think he's a huge influence. I might have felt an extra like special connection to him because he was also a painter before he became a programmer. But yeah, he's a big one, just a really smart guy, writes a lot, writes well, cares about writing, and then cares about startups. So there's a lot of overlap. I think Naval is very wise. I tend to, and he tries to compress the crap out of things, and it makes a very, his consuming his content is very pleasant for that reason, is he's always trying to reduce it to something more abstract and therefore more general. I like Robert Greene, who 48 Laws of Power. I know some people have a bad view of him, but I tend to take an optimistic view. Kevin Kelly is a big one. Just such a creative force and so open and brave, I think, like creatively brave, just kind of does what he wants all the time. There are so many, Huberman is like kind of he's a Stanford neuroscientist, and he does these kind of health podcasts, which I have a bit of a thing for. Those are like some of the ones that come off the top of my head, but there's a handful more. In one of those lists in particular.
That paints a picture. I mean, I think I understand, I'm beginning to understand what we're really talking about here, which is that there's something about, you know, you say put your phone down, you know, you go and have a think. You're creating a world within yourself. You're kind of, yeah, I mean, you're being, and you know, with the big capital B in that sense. And I wonder whether the opposite of that, and it's often useful to look at the opposite of something to understand the thing itself, but is the opposite of that this kind of reduction of people into like a number, and this kind of like totalitizing force of like modernity to like make someone into just like a database entry? And you know, these people you mentioned, I feel like there's like this seeking out of knowledge and wisdom. You know, like, what does that even mean in the age of like AI? Like, what does it mean to be wise? You can't necessarily just prompt your way to wisdom. And so I wonder if what we're really talking about, Kian, is the sense of being in the world, you know, expressing relationships digitally, but not being reduced to the digital in a way. And that's certainly what I feel, you know, again, as an artist, you know, I feel like there's a connection here where I'm attracted to coming to this place. And it's not just me as another database entry, even though part of me is as a technology, but there's also part of me that is, you know, the soul of the person actually using that. Just a couple of ideas there.
No, yeah, I think that's very, interesting, very wise. I think, but I do, yeah, you don't want to completely part yourself out and be fully digitized. It's just like the parts that are necessary for you to communicate yourself. That's the part you kind of want to make digital. And I think that's an interesting way of viewing it. It's like how little of a person can we digitize, or how much can we let them express themselves, like, really, without them being forced to digitize themselves. But it's a big idea.
Yeah, I mean, I asked the question about the smartphones before, but I have this thing, you know, if I have friends visit, you know, I just gently remind them, you know, if we're having dinner, to just, you know, put their phone in their pocket instead of having it on the table. Just because I feel like, you know, if we're there, and I see this all the time around me, man, I live in Japan, you know, everyone's on their phone all the time. And it's like, you know, have a couple, you know, they're on a romantic date, but there's two phones there. That's actually a four-person date happening. And it's just like a different dynamic, you know, and that kind of sense of presence. And I think one of my meta critiques, sorry, this is going off the, you know, off a tangent, but one of my meta critiques of like where we're at right now is that modernity and this kind of like late stage digital culture is trying to like peel off the human and kind of do away with it. And this kind of ideology of like AI and, you know, we're going to just automate all the things, all the jobs are going to go away. You know, that's a certain ideology. Like, that's not truth with a capital T. That's just like where we happen to be going. It doesn't have to be where we end up. And I look at some of these movements towards like localism, towards people using like dumb phones, people using like long format stuff. I write like these long emails to people, like correspondence all the time. You know, I wonder whether that's making a comeback, and not everyone will be on board with that, obviously, but certainly for the intellectuals, for the creators, for the artists, for people who are curious, I guess, you know, there will be an appeal to, I don't know, doing things a little bit differently, perhaps.
Yeah, no, I think you're definitely right. I do think that there is something that we've gotten pretty wrong, and it'll be nice to get back to being more present. I really like the peeling off visualization, because that is, and I think we're doing it to scale. I think it's the reason why we're being asked to peel these layers off of ourselves, is so that the machines that we're making to process our lives have to do like less difficult work to get us through the process. And so they're peeling these layers off. If we're all square shaped, we'll all fit in the square holes of the machines, and then society can run a little more smoothly. Yeah.
There's actually a guy who I was watching his lectures a couple of weeks ago, Matthew Crawford. Have you come across his writing? So he talks about, in reference to AI, he's got some really interesting critiques. Matthew Crawford, he says, the space for intelligent human action is being colonized by machines. And as this happens, our abilities atrophy. And there's this role within that, I think, of these anti-humanists who maybe hide behind something like safety as a keyword, where they say, well, look, we have to make things safe, we have to make things okay for people, as if man, as if humankind is somehow vulnerable to something, whereas, you know, somehow we got to where we are, you know, on our own, yet here we are needing safety. And he's got some really interesting critiques, and maybe I could send you his lecture later, but I thought his his critique of the dominant ideology, especially coming from the big tech world, is that, you know, they say humans are stupid, obsolete, fragile, hateful, and these are all problems that something like AI would fix, and it seeks to fix, you know, AI cars being a perfect example. You know, it's a safer driver, humans are bad drivers. But I don't know, man, that, again, that's not necessarily truth. That's just someone's idea. And I don't know, I'm throwing a bit of stuff at you, but like, that is very interesting, right?
Yeah, no, I do, you know, it's hard to consider how much of life will change as a result of that technology specifically, especially the way some people are imagining it. We're just seeing how fast it's growing. It's really tricky. I haven't given it much thought, but my fear is that it drives us away from something like the internet, because we are crowded out by these human imitators just operating on the internet, and we begin to not be able to tell the difference, and that perhaps forces us to be more local. When I watched Star Wars, I went through and watched the Star Wars stuff recently. And I was thinking about, okay, what if they're post AI? So they don't really use devices or anything. I'm like, what would drive them in a world where they have intelligent machines to not use their screens all the time and, you know, talk to each other via hologram, human to human, and, you know, not just be like VR in a VR chair all day. And I think it's that perhaps like the digital space is not safe from these like human imitators, and they get Sybil attacked out of digital spaces, and like the only way they can like preserve their sanity and have a decent life is they connect more with flesh and blood humans in person. And so maybe the AI, the like AI boom will be a driver in the like localism boom. Maybe it will force us to be more present, because otherwise we are our companions on the internet aren't even people anymore. They're machines that we don't feel the same with.
That's fascinating. I think this really stood out to me. I went to a meetup event recently, and it was like some like VR kind of people, and it was really interesting because I tried the Vision Pro for the first time, and I had used VR stuff before, just, you know, trying it out, playing a few games, but that was the first time I'd used the Apple device, which was, you know, pretty high quality. And as an artist, actually, I kind of wasn't really comfortable with it, because it is totalitizing. Like, there's no screen through which you can delineate your reality and say, well, that inside the screen, that's the computer, but outside is real. It's like, oh, this is like, I kind of like put the thing on to enjoy it, but and to kind of, you know, be nice, someone had offered it, but I was also like, this is really weird, man. And it was like, man, what are you offering me here? Like, it felt like this kind of Faustian bargain. It's like there's a reality within the machine. And I reflect on like the failure of the metaverse and these stupid looking VR goggles, and I think, man, that just cannot be the reality that, you know, humankind opts for. You know, it just felt wrong. And I wonder, again, that was like the metaverse, that's like Zuckerberg, these kind of people kind of assuming what they think is the right way to go about things, and that whole thing has flopped, and it's not really, I don't see it really taking off. And again, I was like, man, like, let's just go outside and touch grass, you know, and have a drink and have some fun. And I wonder whether that is all feeding into this. And I don't know who's writing about this at the moment, but it seems like it's a very important topic. As tech becomes more and more embedded in our lives, that connection to reality, you know.
Yeah, I mean, my sense is the AI stuff becoming ubiquitous. It's inevitability isn't truth, but I, you know, going back to Kevin Kelly, I think he wrote that these kinds of things. He wrote a book about the inevitable technologies. At least like the arrows are in certain directions. I don't think they have to be, you know, a kind of disgusting abuse of humanity in pursuit of their inevitable path. But I think they are going to progress. I think there are people that want them, and it's because they are, it's kind of like Amazon. It's not, it's not 100% gross. It's, you know, it's some percent gross and we all hate it, but it's another percent great. And so we're making those trade-offs. And I think the same is true of something like VR. While it is inferior to grass, if you live somewhere where there's no grass, you know, I want to touch digital grass at least. Give me something. And so I think we'll have gross versions of the technology. Then over time, there'll be quaint, nice versions that we've adapted to. At least that's my hope. I just think it is a very violent time when a technology is emerging. Because you're making more trade-offs than you will have to later when you're adopting it early relative to later. So,
And look, the exciting thing is at this time, people like you and me actually have an opportunity to really throw our lot in and actually nudge things in certain ways just as much as some of these big, these big organizations. You know, there is kind of an opportunity to share and kind of respond to it, right? Which is what I think we are doing. I just coming back to Stack and News, though, I am curious. So you founded this project, but you have some people working with you now. You've got open source contributors as well. Can you maybe just tell me a little bit about sort of the community behind the community of Stack and News?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, the first person who joined Stacker News to work on Stacker News was actually our first investor, Kevin Rook. And so he was seeing me struggle having to do like social media outreach and schedule AMAs. And so he joined. And then EK started contributing to the open source project. He was got interested in Bitcoin stuff. He came across Stacker News somehow. And then he started contributing to the open source project. And I'm like, hey, you're a good programmer. You should let me pay you more money than I'm paying you on the bounties for our open source project and, you know, come in. And so he's joined and he's been with Stacker News now for, I guess, nearly two years, maybe, maybe 18 months. But really, really, you know, Stacker News's quaintness or whatever, it tends to select for very excellent people. And EK is one of them, also a great programmer. More recently, Sox joined our team and similar thing, started contributing to the open source project. You know, great programmer. So we had him come on and but that's it. That's just me and Sox and EK. Kevin was part of the team for a while and then decided to take a break. And then more recently we also have Carr. He helps with the Stacker News Live podcast. We have Pleb Poet, who helps with our zine. We print a little zine, which is really cool, getting back to kind of the local tactile things that are just, you know, for fun and for appreciating reality type of thing. But yeah, the team is very, very small relative to what it might be. And I'd like to keep it that way. The open source contributors are pretty excellent too. Like Stacker News, we have an incentivized kind of open source project where we explicitly say how much we'll pay for things. We try to incentivize all the positive behaviors that we can. We try to disincentivize bad ones. And it's like another incentive game that we're messing around with. And it's gone pretty well. I think I would like to compare us to other open source projects without the incentive structure and see how much better we're doing. But that was an interest of mine before Stacker News was open source. So and the problems there. Yep.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. And I mean, I guess finally, I mean, you're in Austin, right? And there's a little bit of a Bitcoin community there. I mean, just reflecting, because I know there's especially where you are, there's a few other, you know, Bitcoiners hanging out. There's a bit of like a thing going. You guys got a little bit of a hub there. Like, maybe just tell me about Austin as a Bitcoin place.
Yeah. So I don't know exactly how Austin became a Bitcoin place, but I think my understanding of the genesis is that Unchained Capital started here. Yeah. And they got to a certain size where they started attracting talent, and then that talent brought with it, you know, more people moving across the country. Then COVID hit, and then when people were deciding where to go in the United States, Texas seemed like a great place because it was, you know, pretty liberal in terms of if you had to wear a mask or not. And so a lot, like I relocated to Austin around that time, but they had their meetup here got huge. It got like, it was like 200 people every bit devs. And now we have a meetup. We have 4 or 5 different Bitcoin meetups that I'm aware of. There are probably even more. And there's Bitcoin Park now took over Bitcoin Commons here. With Bitcoin Park has a place in Nashville. They're expanding out. And then I'm part of a co-working startup incubator called Pleb Lab. And we try to be, we're kind of like a misfit hacker group where, you know, kind of a lot of us are like odd pieces in the Bitcoin community, or at least we would probably label ourselves that way. We're all just trying to like make stuff together and help each other. And that's kind of,
that's cool, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I reflect on how these communities come about, because, you know, when I was back in New Zealand, I had like a little bit of a co-working space going on. A few of my Bitcoin friends would come through, and it was just a vibe, man. We had some sofas, you know, watched some movies, you know, it's like we had a lot of fun. And I'm still now, you know, where I'm living now, you know, slowly starting to build something similar. But there's something awesome about just having friends that you can hang out with and build stuff with, right?
It's the best. It's so important. Yeah. That's why we did it. I think we started... When Pleb Lab started, there weren't co-working spaces for Bitcoin. And how it ended up starting was I was hanging out with the people who ended up starting Pleb Lab. And I was like, I want to work with Bitcoiners more frequently. Let's have people work out of my, will you guys work out of my garage? I have like a 1-car garage, and I'll just let us all work out of it. And then I put it out on Twitter. It might still to this day be my most popular tweet ever, but I was like, I'm thinking of just letting Bitcoiners work in my garage for free. Would anyone want to do it? And that ended up causing Super Testnet to move to Austin, and then Pleb Lab, and then everyone's like, we don't actually want to work in a garage, but we do want to work together. So Pleb Lab started, and then the Bitcoin Commons emerged, and then Bitcoin Park emerged in Nashville. It was pretty awesome. It like set off a chain, but there's like, and most of that is just from, there's so much value in person, especially, but just connecting with people, talking to people, combining your insights together. It's great.
Yeah. Well, certainly as you wrote, you said something special happens when you share space with people you share values with. So look, man, I think that's awesome. I think we might wrap it up there, Kian. It's certainly been awesome talking to you, finding out about Stacking News. Just quickly though, is there anything you wanted to share in terms of sort of roadmap for 2025, things on your horizon, and also where people can follow you if they would like to learn more?
Yeah. Roadmap is complicated, but one of the things we're really excited about is trying to make territories something that is more sort of atomic and gives people like Stacker News as a tool. It's kind of money as moderation tools, these kind of incentives, this kind of naturalness that they bring. How do we give that to more people and allow them to kind of bring their own communities? So that's something we're working on actively. There's just so much there with the roadmap, but that's like our big thing. We developed all these tools to make Stacker News what it is. How do we give it to more people in a way that they're willing to accept? And then you can find me at stacker.news. That's the easiest way.
That's the place to go, Stacking News. Kian, all right, man. Well, thank you so much for sharing that, for your time. I hope I can come out to Austin sometime. I've never actually been to the US. It's sort of on my big plan to come out and visit Texas and Austin in particular. So, yeah, I do hope we can catch up in person. But otherwise, I appreciate your time and thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Please do come out to Austin. We want you here.
I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.